Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Wednesday, May 31st, 2017. Today we are going to switch our agenda order, and we are going to start with our informational meeting about Medicaid billing opportunities for education. And we will be doing the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2845, second in the agenda. So with that, I would like, I have Dr. Noir, Sarah Drinkwater, and Mitch Kreska on the list, although I do not see Dr. Noir.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner and members of the committee. Sarah Drinkwater, Assistant Superintendent for Student Services with the Oregon Department of Education. And Dr. Noor is not able to be with us right at this moment, so I will start with the introduction. We were invited back to provide more information about Medicaid billing in educational settings. And so with me today are Mitch Kreska and Mr. Blando from Silver Falls School District. So we will be providing some additional information for you. We are very glad to be here, and we will get started. So I will be going over the overview of Medicaid opportunities, Medicaid billing opportunities in school districts. Mitch Kreska will be getting into more of the nitty-gritty about billing, provide kind of a case study for you, and then some conclusions. So first off, there are two types of Medicaid billing in education. One is called MAC for short, or Medicaid Administrative Claiming. And this is these are activities that are reimbursed, and they are outreach activities. So school district staff who can reach out to children and families so that they are aware of the access they may have or their potential eligibility for Medicaid programs and services. The other type of Medicaid billing in educational settings is school health services. And these are services authorized under Oregon's approved Medicaid state plan with that are special education and related services or early intervention services. So two types.
May I confirm?
Yes.
The Oregon's approved Medicaid state plan, is that the plan that is approved by the federal government that the state does for its school services versus the Oregon health plan, et cetera, that is approved internally, and that is how the rest of our Medicaid is administered?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services sort of facilitate and oversee all of those different programs, and our state plan is approved through Oregon Health Authority and is called Oregon State Plan, and parts of that relate to the services that the state can bill for, whether it's educational services, et cetera. So there's a large plan, and Mitch will provide a bit more information about that later.
Thank you.
Sure. So just to provide a little context, the legal setting for this, many of you are very familiar with the Individuals with Disability Education Act, and we know that this means that children with disabilities who are eligible for special education services are provided a free appropriate public education that meet their individual needs. And specifically, Part B of the IDEA guarantees that children and students ages 3 to 21 have this access. In addition, we have an Oregon administrative rule under 581-015-2530 that allows a school district program to use the state's Medicaid and or other public benefits or insurance programs to help provide and pay for special education and related services. So we do have an OAR that allows Medicaid billing. There are a couple of caveats that are a part of this OAR. And the first one is that prior to accessing children or parents' public benefits, we must obtain written parental consent. And when that initial parental written consent is given, then there is an annual notice thereafter. In addition, a family has the right to withdraw their consent at any time, and that would mean that the district could no longer bill under that student's name for the Medicaid services. School health services, because they are part of free appropriate public education, of course, are at no cost to the parent, and they do not affect a parent's community benefits. So specifically related to Medicaid administrative claiming, the way this is done is a random time study. And it's a random time study, and a district is provided a specific date and time, specifically a date, that they are to do their study, and specific staff people then keep track of their time during the time study date. And then all of that is collected. But it's random, and it's not planned. You have a few days' notice, but it is a random time study. Currently, Oregon Health Authority has contracts with 8 educational service districts, and some school districts subcontract with an ESD to do their billing, and some school districts do it on their own and do it through a billing portal. And there have been 65 school districts and ESDs who've participated in this MAC billing. Just as a reference, we know we have 197 school district and 22 ESDs.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This will sound familiar from me, but those 65 school districts, about what percentage of the students in the state do those represent?
I will have to defer to Mitch to answer that question.
Oh, and you might not know off the top of your head.
Actually, I really don't know what. Excuse me. We don't have that number. We can get that number for you, but we don't have.
That would be helpful. Because I feel like it gives us important context. When you have 197 districts, 65 districts could be a third of the students, and 65 districts could be, 80% of the students.
80%. Yeah.
Happy to provide that for you.
Yep.
So to reiterate, the Medicaid administrative match claiming is for outreach activities. So the reimbursement is not about direct services to students. It's access, connection with eligibility, that kind of thing. The cost share for MAC claiming is 50-50. And there is a risk of this activity or claiming not being cost effective. If there are a lot of staff in a school district who are don't engage in these type of activities, and they do participate in the time study, and then none of their hours are associated with outreach activities. So it may end up that it's not very cost effective for this particular claiming, the Medicaid administrative match. Oregon Health Authority does require an annual report on how school districts, ESDs, use the funds for health and social service projects. So let's move to school health services. 63 school districts and ESDs have participated in billing under the school health services. Again, this is related to IDEA, special education and related services. So reimburses the cost of IDEA related service and that are written in a student's IEP. Typically, speech language pathology services, nursing, delegated healthcare services that are delegated from the nurse to another staff person, occupational therapy services, physical therapy, transportation. And so these are considered direct health services under our state plan.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Same question on this, but two parts. Number one, what percentage of kids do those 63 school districts entail? And also, what's the overlap between the 60-something districts that do the MAC and that do the school health services?
Representative Co-Chair Smith-Warner, happy to do that. Not a problem. So continuing with school health services,
a
match rate is determined for a state by the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, FMAP or FMAP. And currently with our Oregon health plan, it's at 35.5%. So the school district, after the reimbursement occurs, it turns out that the school district pays 35.5% and the federal government reimburses 64.5%. When the billing occurs, a school district cannot use federal funds for the outlay of the funds. The reimbursement comes back from Medicaid as federal dollars, but the initial money that the school district or ESD utilizes cannot be federal funds. Reimbursement is cost-based and established on each individual district or ESD's actual cost, because when the program is set up, staff are entered into the program, their salaries, benefits, all of that. So it becomes very individual for a school district. And through the Medicaid program with school health services, there is no annual report required on the use of funds. So fee-for-service, and it's billed directly to state Medicaid or through contracted billing, as I mentioned before. A school district could work through an ESD doing the billing or do it on its own. None of the billing of services includes school-based health centers. They're not included with this at all. And in Oregon, the top three services that schools bill for are speech services, nursing, and transportation, just to give a little bit of context there. And there's no clear requirement from Medicaid on a district of how to use the federal match dollars. So I will turn the microphone over to Mitch Kruska to continue.
Good morning, Representative Smith-Warner, co-chair, and Senator Monroe. Mitch Kruska, Director of Educational Programs, Secondary Transition and Alternate Assessment with the Oregon Department of Education. So what I'm going to talk this morning about is go into a little bit more detail about the actual Medicaid plan that we have. It is approved, as you mentioned, Representative Smith-Warner, that it is approved by CMS, and it is administered by OHA. They are the state representative for all Medicaid billing, and so all the Medicaid billing goes through OHA. So we have a collaborative relationship with OHA and education in order to be able to do this work. The plan identifies, as Sarah mentioned, the plan identifies the services that are reimbursable, that are identified through special education and related services. This is a waiver that we update on a regular basis with CMS. And so as of right now, the current services that are listed are the ones that the state can bill for reimbursement in Medicaid. Oregon is unique among some states because first payer is not the default set for reimbursement for Medicaid, but because Oregon has that as part of its waiver, excuse me, we don't have to exhaust other resources, so the private insurance and other areas, before we bill for Medicaid. Medicaid is the first payer, so we can bill directly to Medicaid for services. A little bit of data for you. This is a graph that shows between 1999 and 2015, the last 17 years, the 16 years worth of data that shows the increase in the cost to school districts, who are, in this case, the school health service providers, the cost of the expenditures for school health services. The majority of the costs that are identified in this graph are staffing costs, but there are some other costs that are included in this as well, and this is ODE data. Along with that data, you see an increase in the number of students that are children that are Medicaid eligible. So as the costs are going up, so are the number of students that are eligible for Medicaid services and therefore Medicaid reimbursement. And then finally, this graph gives you an indication of how much reimbursement the school districts have been claiming from Medicaid over the last between 2009 and 2014. And it really, it's, you have the low of about $3,300,000 in 2009 and the high in 2011 of $6,800,000. And this is information that's provided by OHA. So this gives you an indication of where we're at as far as actual Medicaid reimbursement.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So can you talk a little bit about this slide in particular at all? Like what's driving the ups and downs, since the earlier slides seem to indicate lots more kids Medicaid eligible, yet this does not, the reimbursement certainly isn't tracking with that.
Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith-Warner. Yes, there'll be some more information as we move along, okay, that'll help answer that question. But I guess just to answer the question right right now, the response would be right now, Medicaid reimbursement or requesting Medicaid reimbursement for school district is strictly voluntary. It's up to the school district to decide if they want to set up a system and whether how that system will work. As Dr. Drinkwater mentioned, they could either do it directly with OHA using the billing portal themselves, or they can do it through an ESD or a private organization that will do the billing for them. But it's entirely up to them, and that really that's the best answer I can give you. Each district has to make the decision whether or not they wish to bill for Medicaid or not.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So hearing that, I would presume there is, and the unstated, it's so hard that it's easier for them to eat the costs than to do it. But I mean, the numbers that we're looking at, I guess, am I guessing wrong? I don't want to project, or I don't want to assume anyone's intentions on that. But with that high of a match rate, and that increase in your population, it would have to make it, and ESDs that can provide the service, it's a little.
I will be answering your questions as we move along.
Great. Okay.
This next slide.
Representative Lively, please.
Yes.
Just so I have this correct. So the couple slides back, it talked about total expenditures for health services, and it showed somewhere around $35 million, which I assume when it says total expenditures, that's the total expenditures within the districts, regardless of who paid for it.
Okay. Yes, Representative Smith Warner, Senator Bruno, co-chairs, Senator Representative Lively, that is correct. This is the best data that we can pull because ODE does not collect the data specifically for health services. So we extrapolate, you know, the expenses.
Okay, and I'm just trying to make sure I'm on the same page. And then on the page we just talked about total funds paid, we had something like in the last fiscal year, total funds was about $4 million. So there's some difference between the $4
there
million.
There is. What the first slide shows the expenditures the school districts are making.
Right.
This slide, I'm sorry, go ahead, one more. This is actually the Medicaid reimbursement
right.
The districts have sought. So of the $35 million that was spent, the high mark was $6,800,000.
Okay. That's fine.
You
I'm
got
sure
it.
Sure
okay.
Got it.
All right.
Thank you.
I have
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to slide 13. Are you going to present information about can we relate this to the number of school nurses?
Representative Wisnett, I really can't because there's so many things that go into this number. When you look at the reimbursements, it really goes towards school nursing. But I would imagine we could probably find out what percentage of this actually goes to nurses.
Follow up, sir.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. But I think, are we going to get a slide showing that we have not increased significantly the number of school nurses and maybe have declined? Is that correct?
It's related to this, but school nursing is not the only part of
that.
This. I mean, Medicaid billing is for many things more than just school nursing. So where I understand you're going, it's not specifically called
related.
Out in this presentation.
Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Lively again?
No, I don't think I can. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll move on. So to answer part of the questions that you've asked, this gives you an indication for 2014, the breakdown of Medicaid reimbursements and what those dollars went to. And so you can see that speech language and nursing were really the two areas that were billed for the most. And so those were the two areas that were reimbursed most significantly. Now, as Dr. Drinkwater indicated, we have a guest with us this morning who is a superintendent whose district does actually do billing for Medicaid services. And so I'm going to turn it over to Andy Belando and let him introduce himself.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner Monroe, committee members. I want to share a few thoughts this morning about Silver Falls School District, which is located about 15.
And you have to tell us your name.
I apologize. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My name is Andy Belando, Superintendent, Silver Falls School District. And Silver Falls School District is located centrally in the community of Silverton, located about 15 miles east of Salem. It's a very large school district from a Willamette Valley standpoint, about 260 square miles. And I say that with some intentionality, simply because we have also a large number of schools within our school district, 13 actually, from a small of about 80 students to a large of about 1,300 students at Silverton High School. That size alone and the geographic makeup of our school district makes services in many ways to be administered quite challenging at times. And so a number of years ago, actually 2011, and under the direction of our special education director at the time, we were able to access Medicaid billing services to provide support to help meet the unique needs of our district. And since then, it's been an effective revenue source for us to be able to plan predictably from year to year, with the lion's share of the revenue being applied toward nursing services in Silver Falls School District. So we currently have 2.5 nurses, which is about a 1 to 1,500 one nurse to 1,500 student ratio in the district, and they are able to provide services at each of our schools within the district, even though some of them are 15 and 20 miles or more apart. So the system works, and the system works well. I will share with you that while it's created the predictability and sustained funding specific for nursing services, that opportunity has come with some challenges. The majority of the challenges really have come really with some of the things that you've already heard this morning related to the complexity of the reporting requirements and the need for us to really be on top of our game when it comes to submitting the necessary record keeping and required billing paperwork for this service. We do it directly from the school district, even though we receive services and support from, I believe it was Multnomah ESD at the time, to get this program up and running in Silver Falls School District. We've been able to essentially maintain that on our own over the course of the last 6 or 7 years. So we find it an effective program. We believe it's essential. We believe it's critical. At the same time, we understand the continued challenges for us to be able to continue it. I will share one caveat very quickly, and that is that our assistant secretary to the special education director is retiring this year, and she has been pivotal in helping to establish this program within the school district. So we're doing, again, some front loading as we replace this person in order to continue this this effective program. And I stand here and say it works. It's effective, and I sure appreciate it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Roblin.
So when we did this program a number of years ago at our high school, they came and trained all the teachers. And we had a checklist of the kinds of activities that would qualify. And we were asked every quarter to fill out the form as a teacher, saying we did this particular thing and X, Y, Z. And then all of that was gathered. I think it went to the ESD. Do they still do that, or is it specifically dealt with by nurses, other kinds of health professionals? Or do they still have the ability to bill for services that happen in a classroom when a teacher is taking care of a particular kid or whatever?
Yeah, I could be mistaken, Senator Roblin. Mm-hmm. I believe you're referring to the Medicaid survey revenue, where my comments were more directed towards Medicaid direct billing. However, we also administer that within our school district, okay. And teachers do receive training and then are randomly sampled throughout the course of a school year. I don't remember the number of times. I believe it's three.
Okay.
And we do generate additional revenue as well. That's okay. That continues to be in place.
Okay, that's good to know.
So,
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Co-Chair. Just briefly, so to clarify, what your district does is both the MAC and the SHS?
That's correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
That was my question.
Okay.
Because, Mr. Co-Chair.
Great minds thinking alike. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you for that compliment. You like that.
Flattered.
High Desert ESD used to do both. Now they're just doing the administrative claiming, the MAC. They said they thought it was easier. You think that's true? Or, Superintendent, could you comment on that, sir?
I'm only pausing because of the word easier. this is not necessarily an easy system to navigate. However, with the front loading that we've been able to provide, we are able to continue the systems that we have in place to make it work. I appreciated Co-Chair Smith-Warner's comment earlier about the value of this program as compared to the effort that it takes to put into it, and she is correct. However, we've discovered that both programs are effective and incredibly valuable resources and money, not just for the revenue purpose, but for the predictability of the revenue that we're able to maintain from year to year. And I don't think it's anyone would disagree that year-to-year funding for a school district in general can be entirely unpredictable. So having a revenue source that we can have that predictability is so important. I can't speak specifically for the High Desert. However, that would be my comment on that.
Thank you very much.
Representative Parrish.
I've got a couple questions, if you indulge me there, Mr. Chair. So under this program, I mean, how many kids are you actually able to serve with, your slide says you identified 15 highest need students, but overall, how many kids are you billing for?
I can't share. Good morning, by the way, Representative Parrish. I can't share with certainty, but the figures that you've seen are from, I believe, 2014. And the complexity of our students have increased, and I can share with certainty that the high cost numbers within our district have increased. So I think it's fair to say that the number that we've served in parallel have also increased through our Medicaid revenue sources. So with that said, let me give you two trains of thought. One of them are specific to direct billing. I'm going to take a bit of a guess, but I believe it's at least double that at this point for direct billing for Medicaid direct billing. For the Medicaid survey revenue, though, we now have nursing services in all of our schools within the district, something that we did not have in 2011. So while the direct billing recipients are high-cost, high-disability needs students directly, all students in the district are receiving some services from one or both of these funding sources.
Go ahead.
So I guess I'm looking at your student body, looking at geographically where you live. I'm going to assume you have a fairly high free and reduced population, which leads me to believe that you have more kids who are qualified and Medicaid eligible. They might not be your highest need students. Are you working at all to interface with the CCOs that these kids belong to? Or are you just kind of, I'm trying to wrap my head around why our K-12 system is not connecting to our CCO system. I get that we can directly bill Medicaid, but it strikes me that there are a lot of healthcare services being delivered in the classroom, maybe not to your highest need students, but to kids who qualify for Medicaid, and how we are not doing, I think, a good job as a state of connecting those kiddos with their regular healthcare providers, and we're kind of double dipping healthcare dollars potentially by not being more coordinated. That's not a you issue. I think it's just a structurally we're not designed that way, but I think we need to move that direction. And so I'm kind of curious, like, how many other Medicaid kids do you potentially have that are not being served either through the system doesn't serve you that way, you don't have the FTE to do that, or just schools aren't designed to sort of track the sheer amount of healthcare being delivered during the K-12 school day?
I can comment with what I know specific to the community of Silverton and Silver Falls School District that I believe you're likely correct that there are some kids that may not be served. I think some of that may have to do with just the reality of parent permission to be able to work with parents and seek those additional services. I will say we are fortunate in that we live in an area, and this is not the case everywhere, of course, where we do have a healthcare provider being Legacy Silverton Health within the community of Silverton. Our nurses are contracted directly from Silverton Health, and so as a result, they not only have that direct connection between Silverton Health and all the providers within Silverton Health, but they're able to make those direct connections within to the school. So that's a bit of a luxury for us that we have that other communities who do not have a centralized healthcare provider like Silverton Health can provide.
And if I could, I'd like to also add a couple of comments about that. I want to make sure that we clarify that there's a difference between serving the students who are Medicaid eligible and billing for the students who are Medicaid eligible. All students who are on an IEP will receive the services regardless of who pays for them, whether it be the school district and the school district is reimbursed, they will receive the services that they're entitled to. And then the other piece that you mentioned, the CCOs, is that there's a very fine line, in some cases not so fine of a line, between a CCO providing services that the school district is responsible for and the whole supplementing versus supplanting. And so it can be difficult to negotiate with a CCO or a private insurer around what they should pay for versus what the school district should pay for under FAPE, which is free appropriate public education. So it's sometimes it's not such an easy line to draw, and there's work to be done with that. So
can I follow up to that?
Go ahead, please.
So we had a screen and another presentation somewhere earlier in the legislative session about the high need students around the state. That dollar figure was like something pushing towards $100 million, and we see a screen where, you know, Medicaid billing is only like $4 million. I mean, to me, there's just a disconnect. And most of those children, even if they come from a higher socioeconomic home, you're still going to have a big chunk of those dollars that we're using ed dollars for that really should be Medicaid dollars. And there, that's a big chunk of money that I feel like we're leaving on the table and are very disconnected from. And that doesn't get into the healthcare around, you know, where you're dealing with a child who maybe is not on an IEP or 504 or, you know, any type of plan, but who's Medicaid, and you're dealing with the daily, like, diabetes or just kind of management of some health issue that really isn't part of, you know, the school day. And is part of their overall life needs of health care that, to me, really should be aligned with health care dollars and not ed dollars. And that's the piece that I want to spend the next, you know, year or so trying to break down and figure out how do we do a better job of this, because I feel like we're leaving a boat ton of dollars on the table. And those kids are then being served under the Medicaid dollars in a different capacity, and those systems aren't talking to each other, and it is driving up costs in both sectors of our budget, and we've got to do something to address that.
Was that a question or a speech?
No, it was. I'm putting that out there for anybody who wants to work on that issue. We are going to talk about that later this summer with the Lund Report and do a panel on this issue, but I just feel really strongly that when I see two different slides and two different presentations and they are not congruent, that's a problem, and it's a big chunk of money.
Yes. Thank you very much. Senator Roblin.
Thank you. And it was mentioned earlier that the reimbursement money that comes back does not have to be spent on health care. It can be spent where the district wants. Do most of them spend it on health care? Because I thought it had to be spent on health care. And is that how you get your nurses, and now you cover in Silverton all of your students, is using some of this Medicaid reimbursement money to hire, contract, as you do, with Legacy?
Yeah, that's been the majority of the revenue use. We have used for other health needs, such as health supplies. We've purchased AEDs installation at each of our schools as well. So those and related supplies are really the predominant use in health and nurses.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Andy. So this slide gives you an indication of just where Oregon lies compared to other states who also claim Medicaid reimbursement. And what this slide really indicates is there are some states that do it well, but it's all over the board. And when you look at all 50 states plus the non-state entities that also bill Medicaid, it really is all over the board. There really is no consistency in who bills and how much they bill for.
Madam Co-Chair, could I request that slide maybe come back with some percentages on it to give us a better sense? Like, if you were to establish that, give it a dollar per student number, I feel like that would give us a better read.
Got another slide
across
show
the
how much
okay.
If you can,
but
okay, yeah, good idea.
Just because.
Okay.
So in my head, I'm like, okay, so they've got about twice this population of us, but just it would be easier to. Yep. Sorry.
But if you're asking that, do you want it? Thank you.
Yeah.
If you do, you want it by total spent per and student, or do you want it federal money to student? Do you want it federal money and state money to student? What all do you want when you're asking that question? I see three.
I guess
questions.
I don't, yeah. Through the chair. I would just argue, I don't feel strongly about how, just to give me kind of a consistent way to see it across those states. I don't have strong feelings about.
Okay. Idaho looks like it does very well.
Yes, it does.
Indeed.
Okay. We. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, we can do that.
Thanks.
Yeah. So now I'm going to go into and talk a little bit about some of the obstacles. And we've mentioned it. We've heard a few of those already this morning, but some obstacles to billing for Medicaid and some of the things we hear as we're out in the field talking to districts around why they do or don't bill Medicaid. As Andy mentioned, the complexity of the billing process itself is a barrier. It's not an easy system to work. It's time consuming. It puts a lot of extra burden on the individuals who have to track their hours in 15-minute increments in order to be able to bill. So it is a complex system. There's also the piece that you have to do the upfront matching for the district account. As we saw in the case study, Silver Falls brings in roughly $500,000 a year in Medicaid reimbursement through both the administrative claiming and also the direct services, which means that in order for them to access that $500,000, they have to put 35% or $175,000 aside as their matching portion. That again, as I mentioned, the increased school staff time, not only are you doing the work with the students, but you have to track your time in order to be able to bill for it and document it in order to be able to cover if you are audited. You have to be able to justify that the claims were legitimate. And again, that goes into the next one, that fear of being audited and finding that you did something wrong and you either have to pay money back or additional sanctions. There are several folks who talk. Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. That was specifically what I was asking about before. But also, the idea of the upfront funding, my understanding from how this was talked about is that these are services that you have to provide for these kids anyway.
That is correct.
And so I would argue you're spending the money. It's the opportunity to get some chunk of it. But, you know, with all due respect to the complexity and everything,
yes.
I feel like that is the least compelling argument, because if you're spending the money anyway, the advantage of getting some of it back.
Co-chairs and Representative Smith-Warner, but you do have to set the money aside in a fund. I believe, and I'm not going to speak out here, but I will bring information back for that. But I believe you have to set the fund aside. It's not just expending it. You have to have the money set aside before you can seek reimbursement. But I'll verify that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. There are some folks that will say it's just simply not worth it. The time and the effort and the energy going into it, it just is not a cost benefit for the amount of reimbursement that you receive. Parental consent is another issue that comes up, as Andy mentioned and Dr. Drinkwater mentioned. You do have to have parental permission, signed parental permission, in order to be able to bill for students' Medicaid services. And the parent can withdraw that consent at any time. And this really gets to the difference between mandating that you bill 100% of services versus mandating that you bill for services made available. It's almost impossible to guarantee that you can get 100% of parents to agree to allow you to bill, but you certainly can. Every district should be in a position to be able to bill. So I just want to make sure that we're clear about that.
Representative Lively.
So I'm just like, and I've heard this from my district, I'd just like to understand a little bit more the apprehension of parents. To me, it appears the advantage is to get the money so we can make sure all the services are available. So I'm unclear as to the apprehension of the parents providing consent.
Co-chairs, Representative Lively, my guess would be that a lot of it has to do with they're afraid that if they give permission, information is going to be shared about their child, and it gives their, my guess would be there'd be some concern about how much access do I have to give to my child's information in order for you to be able to bill Medicaid. So that's certainly one of them that I'm aware of. I'm sure there are others as well. Okay. And then finally, one of the things we hear is that there's such a high caseload for nurses and other individual speech language therapists, OT, PTs, occupational therapists, physical therapists, school psychs, that again, the time and effort that it takes to not only do the work, but then track the data that you need to justify and document the work is burdensome. Then finally, there's also the possibility of Medicaid funding cuts at the federal level. This next paragraph, I want to point out the key here is that even though the school-based health service reimbursement accounts for only 1% of the actual Medicaid, federal Medicaid reimbursements, it brings in $4 to $5 billion to the Medicaid funds each year for school districts. If school districts were to have those dollars cut or reduced, as Representative Smith Warner pointed out, the services still have to be provided, and so it's going to provide an additional burden on not only the IDEA funds that districts receive, but also the general fund that they receive as well. So what are the current existing Medicaid billing options? As with Silver Falls School District, you can work directly with OHA, who runs the portal for Medicaid billing, and you can enter that portal and have access to it and put in the information and bill directly. And it's important to recognize that that is a portal. It is not a database. You just, whatever you put into it is all that's in there and you can pull out. There's also ESDs in the state that do this work for school districts, and MESD is the example we have here with their ORMED system. It is an electronic billing submission system. This is really a database, though, because they do have a verification system where the students' information on their IEP and other services are in the system to verify what's being sent to OHA, and then the ESD interfaces with OHA to do the actual billing to Medicaid for reimbursement. And then the other option would be there are private agencies out there in the country that do Medicaid billing for states and for different agencies within the states. They would not be Oregon specific, but they also do this work as well.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Do we know a school district or a school that uses a private for-profit provider?
Co-Chairs, Representative Smith Warner, to be honest with you, I'm not aware of any private companies in the state that are doing this work right now. The ones I'm familiar with are the ESDs. We could find out if there is, if you would like to know.
Sure.
Okay.
So,
Senator Roblin.
So, are most of them going through the ESDs? Our district, I know, did, but are standalone like Silverton?
Co-Chair Senator Roblin, it's a split.
Okay.
It really is a split. There's two or three ESDs that do it. They do capture some, and then there are some districts that, like Silver Falls, okay, that go directly through. Yeah. So it really is. It's a mix.
Okay.
So to get to the question that everybody's been really asking, what are we estimating would be the reimbursement amounts that we could get through Medicaid if every district billed comprehensively? Right now, there are currently 576,000 students enrolled in the state of Oregon. About 13% of those are IDEA, special ed eligible, 76,820. Of that, we guesstimate that about 58% of those are eligible for Medicaid as well. So for the reimbursement, that's about $44,617 per $44,617 students, excuse me. When we've done the calculations working with OHA and the folks at OHA who do the Medicaid reimbursement, what we've found is that on average, it's about $1,000 per student reimbursement. So we're looking at, if we were to comprehensively bill Medicaid for those services, we'd generate approximately $44,617,000. However, there are some caveats that I want to point out. First of all, if we're going to do comprehensive billing, we need to build a system in order to be able to do that. We need to have one consistent system that can do the work. There needs to be a great deal of training and ongoing support in order to be able to maintain those systems, not only at the state level, but within the school districts because we all know we have turnover. So we may have someone who's very knowledgeable about the system, system who then leaves, we need to have somebody available to come in and help do the training for the ongoing system. And then, of course, there's the whole idea around district buy-in. Districts have to believe that this is cost-effective and that the system is made as easy as possible for them to be able to access. So those are some of the caveats that the department sees. Finally, along that same line, there are two bills right now that are pending in the legislation. Senate Bill 111 looks at setting up a pilot program, providing some minimal funding to ODE for staff in order to be able to build a statewide system, in order to be able to work on developing the training protocols and the supports that will be necessary in order to implement this system statewide. Then there's House Bill 2223, which really does the same thing, except it requires all districts to start billing within a timeline, but it still gives the department the staffing support and the time that they need in order to build the system and to get the system up and running for districts to be able to access. Again, key here being both pieces of legislation do provide that the Department of Education will provide the technical support and the ongoing training and service to the districts that are accessing the billing system.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So the question I have around, you know, getting to this, because this is sort of where my head is at, is how do you get this accomplished, is, you know, what in our existing Medicaid infrastructure is out there that would create the ability for us to not to go out and reinvent a new wheel, and whether that's using technical expertise from OHA, using technical expertise from CCOs, it strikes me that, you know, going out and building a parallel system to something that already exists is maybe not the most cost-effective way, but I don't know if there's anything in federal law that precludes us from crossing over into and building those partnerships. It just would strike me that there are already experts who do this at a bigger scale without having ODE go out and create a wheel.
Co-chairs, Representative Parrish, what you're indicating is accurate. What the department, our plan would be to work with OHA as our close partner, which we've done with this from the very beginning, as the last year and a half, 2 years that we've been working on this project. And that what we would do is we would not create the system. What we would do is we would identify somebody that could come in and provide the system, and ODE would act as the contract manager. So, for example, and again, I just, because we use it as example, MESD has a program called ORMED. What we would do is we would work with the MESD in order to be able to expand their program to be able to cover the costs and the services of billing for all 197 school districts in the state. Right now, I believe they do about 16 school districts they bill for. So we would not recreate the wheel. Essentially, what the department would do is the department would become the overseer of the system. And we would work with our partners, both state agencies and also billing agents, whoever that would be, in order to create the system that the districts could come to, so that rather than having five or six different billers or systems in place, we would have one system in place.
We're going to need to wrap this up very quickly. We've got Senator Roblin and back to Representative Parrish, but we have a work session and public hearing still scheduled.
My only thing was OHA is the second ODE, right? On your fourth bullet. It's not both ODE.
No. The bills call out for ODE to provide both.
Okay.
Now,
provided by ODE and ODE?
Yes, it would be that we would provide the technical assistance and we would also develop the billing system in conjunction with OHA.
So, no, okay,
with OHA. And if I'm sorry if I misspoke.
No, I think you
yes,
got that.
Yes, we would be basically, because OHA holds the billing portal, we would work with OHA and we would come up with that third, we would identify that third party group that the districts would go to bill, and then that third party group would work with OHA to actually access the portal.
Okay.
Representative Parrish.
A real quick follow-up was on a previous screen, you know, you showed other states that are doing this quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have a sense of how they are doing the billing and either software they're using or even how they distribute that across their system? Some of those states have more kids than we have.
Yep.
What does that look like, and are you talking
to answer the question? It's exactly what we've described. Colorado is a really good example, and Colorado does not mandate that its districts bill, but they've developed a system where all districts can access, and in working in conjunction with their version of OHA, their health services program. program that has the portal and the Department of Education, they've been able to maximize the billing. So what we've described is pretty much what exists around the country. So we wouldn't be remaking the wheel. We would certainly be looking at others to see, you know, and including, you know, who do they have that acts as their billing agent in order to be able to determine what would be the best approach for the department to take.
Okay, can we wrap up the what's finished here?
I think we have already provided many of the benefits, and in conclusion, there are benefits to Medicaid billing, taking advantage of partnerships. Resources are maximized. It's an efficient method of providing necessary medical care. Districts can leverage federal funds to recover a portion of the costs that they've already incurred. We spoke about the importance of the development of infrastructure for scaling this out and up, and that LEAs do require some foundational support. This is a high visibility program that does experience lots of audits. And just in conclusion, we will provide this information, Representative Smith-Warner, but you had asked earlier about the percentage of the student population that participates in either MAC or the Student Health Service, and it's not quite 33% of both of each. About 31% of the student population is billed through the MAC, the outreach, and 29.2% the student population in the health services. But we'll provide that to you.
And what those
are. Yes.
Yeah, Representative Wisnett.
I'll close. Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to compliment Public Health, Oregon Health Authority, and ODE, especially Mitch, for his idea. This is, I've worked on improving school nurses for at least 10 years. We've had studies and studies. Every one of the studies seems to come up, we need more school nurses. And I think the 2223 provides a way to quickly provide more school nursing services, also nurses. But also, the committee should be aware, I was hoping OSEA would be here to testify. They're really concerned about the continued requirements put on staff in schools to do medical services, which were just one disaster away from a tremendous suit by having staff do nursing services for our students. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And at this time, I will open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2845. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn this over to Krista, who's behind me, to handle this bill, but I do need to announce there will be a meeting of this subcommittee tomorrow, and we'll be posting the bill, which is a state school fund bill, immediately after this meeting for tomorrow.
The big one. Okay. Some have been wondering when we would get to start voting.
I was wondering that in February.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2845 requires the Oregon Department of Education to convene a 13-member advisory group to review the current standards for social sciences and identify opportunities to recognize histories, contributions, and perspectives of ethnic and social minorities. The measure has a $43,149 general fund impact for one limited duration position, which is a 0.25 FTE in the 2017-19 biennium. And that appropriation is reflected in the Dash A5 amendment, which is loaded online in OLIS as recommended. And these are.
Thank you very much. Looks like Senator Frederick is here. And so why don't you come on up, and our own Diego will join him.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Barbara Smith-Warner. For the record, my name is Diego Hernandez. I am a state representative for House District 47, East Portland. It is with great pleasure that I bring to you HB 2845. So I'll just give you a brief background for how we even got here. We formed a very diverse set of organizations and coalition of folks who were interested in figuring out how we could improve our education system in an equitable way in terms of learning about histories of different identities in which have occurred in the United States but haven't been reflected necessarily in the education system in K through 12. So this group has convened for a while now, and one of the recommendations that came out of, and I'll mention some of the organizations, and most of you are familiar with them, Oregon Education Association, Chalkboard Project, Coalition of Communities of Color, APANO, Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, Oregon Student Association, Momentum Alliance, including myself, were part of this group. And so one of the and we had superintendents, we had teachers, and one of the conversations that led to what you have in front of you today was around social studies. As you know, Oregon Department of Education revises social studies standards, and they were in the midst of it, and we felt as a coalition that the outreach in which the department had done didn't necessarily reach all of our communities, or nor were we part of any of the work groups that actually were able to recommend future social study standards. So therefore, we decided to come up with an opportunity to influence and make sure that our communities have a voice in the process. And we did it in a way that we made sure that those voices that have historically been underrepresented get to be represented in analyzing current social studies and making recommendations as to what we need. So what does the bill do? What is ethnic studies? So ethnic studies under this bill is defined as the histories and contributions of ethnic and social minorities. Ethnic minorities include people from Alaska Native American people and African, Asian, Pacific Island, Chicano, Latino, Middle Eastern, and Jewish descent. Social minorities include women, people with disabilities, immigrants, refugees, and people who are LGBTQ identity. Together, ethnic and social minorities make up the majority of Oregon in the U.S. and the world. So that under the bill, that's how we define ethnic studies. So it's not just when you hear ethnic identity. I know most folks tend to think just about race or ethnicity. But in this context, it also means social minorities. It's actually a discipline that has existed for many decades, since the 1960s. You can actually get an ethnic studies degree at most Oregon public universities, even a master's. And in other states, you can get doctorates in many different subjects within ethnic studies. And, you know, maybe some of you have taken a class or two. Hopefully. So this bill convenes a work group of 13 folks. The Oregon Advocacy Commissions get to appoint representatives from each of those commissions, Commission on Women, Commission on Hispanic Affairs, Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander, and Commission on Black Affairs. Is it Black Affairs or African American?
Yeah, Black Affairs.
And also some teachers, some Oregon Department of Education equity folks. But in the bill, it's laid down of who all exactly are those 13 members, including folks from representing the Middle Eastern and Jewish descent, which was an amendment that we added. So this bill did go through the policy committee and has been amended several times. We worked with Oregon Department of Education to make it work more efficiently and effectively. The original cost of this bill was three times the price tag in which you see in front of you. So we were able to work with ODE to still make the goals of our original intent possible and yet still have the bill cost the low price it has at this moment. So let me just quickly talk about the research that shows why ethnic studies is so beneficial, especially for communities that are very diverse. For example, one Stanford study on high school student enrollment in ethnic studies class found that students not only increased their attendance and grades, they also increased the number of course credits And we all know, like, if you get to learn about American history in a way where you see yourself reflected in it and you see yourself as part of it, that you will find yourself more as part of the fabric of this country and therefore apply yourself and have a sense of community. But we all know that at this moment in time in our history, we still struggle with white supremacy and racism and other forms of hate and discrimination that unfortunately sometimes shows up in our classrooms in a very individual way, but also systemically because of our policies in the past and our funding mechanisms of the past and how that has influenced our current student population. So I'll wrap it up there. The way that this bill would work is this advisory group of very diverse stakeholders will make recommendations, will review the current updated social studies standards and make recommendations as to which standards could be more inclusive and more diverse, and or recommend new standards within the parameters of what ethnic studies and the discipline stands for. If you look at the bill language, it does advise that that it increases cultural competency, that it promotes critical thinking, so those are some of the broad goals that is set for this work group. Those are really key because we want to make sure that whatever happens, whatever standards, broad goals that get set, that it is critical thinking, that it is history that has occurred, that hasn't been reflected. So with that, you know, I taught for a few years. I worked with young people. I ran a nonprofit for a while. And you cannot believe how, and as somebody who went to K through 12 schools in Oregon and then went on to higher education and actually learned, I took ethnic studies course at the University of Oregon, and I got to learn about history in a way that I didn't get taught growing up in this country. Yep. And I felt different about who I was, and I felt much more proud and much more uplifted to say that I am actually American, and my ancestors did a lot of work to make sure that I have the freedom and the rights that I do have now. And even the Chicano American leaders that fought for these civil rights, to learn about their names and their histories really impacted me. And I think that students who have that opportunity to learn about people who look like them or people who have similar identities as them, they will also have more self-esteem and be impacted in a positive way and therefore contribute to our country in a much more positive way. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Senator Lou Frederick, who has something amazing to show you that I didn't even know about.
Thank you very much. Chairs, co-chairs, and members of the committee, thank you. Good to see you folks. I don't get a chance to see some of my House colleagues as often as I used to. I think that this basically taps into a simple thing. Kids are curious. We want them to be as curious as possible. I always believe that they are basically cultural anthropologists trying to figure out where they fit in. And one of the problems is that often they are not shown where they might fit in. I was lucky enough to grow up in historically black colleges and universities. So I knew where Timbuktu was and how important it was in terms of the libraries and the culture that was there in Mali. These are things that are not often known in other parts of the country. Apparently, I didn't find that out until I got away from Atlanta in the South and some of the places that were teaching me this, all these things, and I found out that my colleagues didn't know about that. They didn't know about certain people. They might have heard of certain folks. I also had in my family the ability to really tap into places. I'm in the middle of writing a book about my dad right now, and he was the last lab assistant for George Washington Carver. So he's more than willing to tell me about all the things that took place leading into that and how the black scientists had such an impact on what was going on and what has gone on in this country.
That's not known as well as it should be, frankly, in K-12. Despite efforts over the decades to try to do something about this, in 1980, the Portland Public Schools started putting together a group called the Baseline Essays. If you want to look it up, Baseline Essays, Portland Public Schools, you can Google that, and find that they put together four different essays, one on African-American, Latino-American, Native-American, and Asian-American. The Asian-American one is so broad, it's a little bizarre, but it talks about a very simple thing. What are the contributions of these communities to the culture of the world, and specifically to the culture of the United States? These are the kinds of things that I think we need to encourage and support. This particular bill is an attempt to encourage that. It's an attempt to try to bring some of these folks together to get them to work on understanding where certain things fit in. Now, I have a couple of things I'd like to just read. This is a quote about a quote. So there was an excellent speech that was made by Mayor Mitch Landrieu talking about in New Orleans, talking about a number of things that happened in the last month or so, taking down monuments in the city. And he quoted President Obama. He said that we need to contextualize and remember all of our history. He recalled a piece of stone, a slave auction block engraved with a marker commemorating a single moment in 1830 when Andrew Jackson and Henry Clay stood and spoke from it. Obama said, consider what this artifact tells us about history. On a stone where day after day for years, men and women bound and bought and sold and bid like cattle on a stone were worn down by the tragedy of over 1,000 bare feet. For a long time, the only thing we considered important, the singular thing we once chose to commemorate as history with a plaque, were the unmemorable speeches of two powerful men. A piece of stone, one stone. Both stories were history. One story was told, one story forgotten, or maybe even purposefully ignored. There are folks who need to understand that. We have that situation in Oregon as well. I just got this yesterday. I don't know if you've seen it or not. It's an interesting book. Bill Hansel, Senator Hansel, gave this to me. It's a book about the Pendleton Roundup and some of the folks who were in the Pendleton Roundup. When I was a reporter, I did stories on the Pendleton Roundup, went over and got a picture from the Historical Society, from the East Oregonian. It had a bucking bronco on the front page and a rider on the bronco. And what was interesting for me was that the name of the horse was listed. The rider was not. And I mentioned that in my story. And then I got a phone call from a fellow who was obviously up in age. And he said, well, I know who that was. That was George Fletcher. And if you don't know George Fletcher, you should get a chance to look at this book. George Fletcher was one of the most important rodeo riders in 1911. There's a lot of things listed. I won't read the caption on this because it doesn't say George Fletcher. It says N word George on the horse here that was on the written in as a caption for the thing. But we have. We have that kind of thing in Oregon. We have that kind of thing with the Latino community, the Asian community, and a whole slew of different communities. They are now going to be part of this group to make decisions about social studies in the state. I think that would be a great idea. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have three people that have signed up to testify. Maria Martinez, Rochelle Covington, and Max Jensen. Come on up. You can take all three of you at once. And thank you for coming. We are running out of time, so if you could just take a few seconds each and let us know what you think of this bill.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Maria Martinez Gutierrez. I am a sophomore at Western Oregon University studying middle high Spanish education. I'm here today to ask you to support House Bill 2845, the Ethnic Studies Bill. My K-12 schooling was here in the Salem-Keizer School District. I had the unique experience of being in a dual language program, and although I did develop bilingual skills and an appreciation for Latin American culture, I felt that I needed to act white in order to be considered successful and smart here. As our schools become more diverse, it is essential that we address history and cultures of all students in the classroom so that they feel worthy of success and so that all can grow an appreciation for each other.
Thank you.
Thank you, representatives and senators, for hearing my story. My name is Rachelle Covington. I'm 15 years old and I'm a sophomore student at Rex Putnam High School. I'll be testifying in support of the Ethnic Study Bill. It is important for me to be here as early as 8:30 a.m. on a school day because I strongly believe in making a difference not only in my high school but in my community. Ethnic studies is important issue to me because my history goes beyond slavery, something that is mostly taught in our classrooms about African American history. I vision a K-12 where my baby brother is able to pick up a history book and see more than slavery in those textbooks, to learn who their ancestors were and that they weren't just slaves, but the culture and communities they were taken from, and the cultures and communities you create to survive beyond slavery. Imagine the positive impact you create in the generations to come and provide answers to many unanswered questions we grew up thinking about. That is why I urge to support Ethnic Study Bill and think about which side of history you would like to be a part of.
Thank you very much.
Hi, good morning. I'm Max Jensen. I work with the OSA and the LGBTQA3 at the University of Oregon. I'm here in support of HB 2845. I wrote the issue brief that the OSA used to push for this bill, which was based on California's SB 48. I grew up a gay kid in a small town where I felt very alone. I had to work really hard to find role models for myself growing up because they weren't in our textbooks, they weren't talked about in our classes, and I couldn't ask any of my peers or my parents to find them. I learned when I was 7 years old what the word gay was when a peer of mine punched me in the gut. I was terribly unhappy all through my childhood. My grades were terrible. I didn't graduate with my peers. When I was 14, the students in my school chased me out of my hometown. I had to switch school districts to find a safer place to study. Studies have shown that inclusive curriculum reduces these instances significantly. If I had learned the word for what I am from a teacher instead of one of my peers or been given role models from my classes, I probably would have felt like I had more of a future, and I probably would have felt like my authority figures would defend me when needed, and that my education was something that would have been more worthwhile to invest my time in. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all three of you coming. This is very important. I'm sorry we didn't have a greater amount of time, but we need to be taking action on this. We haven't had too many votes in this subcommittee, and starting today, that's going to change. Is there an amendment that we need to adopt first?
Mr. Chair, LFO recommends adoption of the -A5 amendment, which appropriates $43,149 in general fund to the Department of Education, and it sunsets the bill on January 2nd, 2020.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the -A5 amendment to House Bill 2845.
Is there discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Motion's adopted.
Okay. Mr. Chair, LFO recommends that House Bill 2845, as amended by the A5 amendment, be moved to the Ways and Means Full Committee.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2845, as amended, to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion. Representative Parrish.
So I'm also glad to be a chief sponsor on this bill. I didn't get up and testify. I want to make sure students had a chance to speak, but I want to weigh in for just a moment. To me, bill like this, especially in light of what happened last week in Portland. It's really important. I didn't know that there were racial slurs for people of Arab descent until the first Gulf War, and I was pretty shocked to hear it. And I grew up in, I was in an inner city high school, so I wasn't out hearing that from white students. I was hearing that from other students of color, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. My family's from the Middle East, and we never knew those words existed, and they did, and they were hurtful at the time when we heard them. And then, you know, to me, looking, I serve on the Veterans Affairs Committee, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday. You know, we've been in a sustained war against the Middle East for the last 16 years. So two of my children have never known a day that this country has not been at war. Yeah. And the images that we see, the social media that they are exposed to, the 24-hour news cycle, it's no wonder you have somebody like the person in Portland who just finally blows up and explodes, and particularly around a section of the world that we are in our the nation's longest war we've ever had. So I appreciate that Representative Fernandez included the piece on the Middle East, and we did some amendment to really clarify who comes to the table. And I'm, you know, growing up in Oregon, was proud of our history. First Arab American governor comes out of this state. We have a commission on Black Affairs, Hispanic Affairs, commission on women because of an Arab governor and a legislature that felt that addressing those needs even 30 years ago was important. And so this really is a continuation of what people like Senator Winters have done when she was the ombudsman in those offices at that time, and others who've said that it's an important piece of our history and we need to make sure it's included. So I'm glad to be a sponsor on this bill, and I'm ready to vote yes.
Thank you. I'd just like to make a couple of comments. I was appointed by that governor, Vic Atiyah, to serve on the Commission on Black Affairs, where I served for 20 years, and am currently the Senate representative. I was a teacher, a high school teacher of history and government for many years, both at the high school level and then later at the college level. My experience was that the ethnic diversity of our nation is one of our great riches. When you travel around the country, the world, you often end up in a country like China, where, except for tourists, all you see are one particular ethnic group. But in the United States, we have this vast conglomerate of ethnic individuals from various kinds of backgrounds. And yes, I know where Timbuktu is. It's in Mali, which is in Central Africa. But I found that when I was a teacher, I was one of the very few true history teachers in a large high school, because most of the social studies teachers were coaches, and their primary interest was in coaching. I had a master's degree in United States history with minors in government and in Russian history, and I was a true history teacher. Later went on to teach at the college level as well. And I always emphasized the ethnic richness of our nation and the contributions of Native Americans, African Americans, Hispanic, whatever, and the key leaders from all those. So it gives me a great deal of pleasure to support this bill today and bring it on to the Ways and Means Committee. Further discussion. Senator Roblin.
Yeah, I'll just say, I hope that as we continue this movement to really have the conversations, that we'll start to do things like make sure that other disciplines besides social studies take responsibility for this. You know, for me, teaching math was really important to me. I loved math, and I realized that most of the math that I loved didn't come from Western society. It came from the Arab society, yes, and the Indian subcontinent and China. And we forget those things. We tend to run everything through our European lens as opposed to where all of these things started. And just knowing that can be helpful to some of your students and makes them feel good. So I would hope that as teachers go through the program, as we get more and more of this understanding, that we will make sure that in all the subjects we teach, not just history, we acknowledge the contributions that were made by a lot of these societies and individuals throughout the world, because we got here today because all of us contributed. And I'm proud to be a sponsor in this bill as well.
Good. Okay, I guess we're ready to vote. Is there any objection to the motion to carry this bill to the full Ways and Means Committee? Seeing no objection, the bill is moved unanimously, and we need carriers. Diego, are you on full Ways and Means? You're not on full. Okay. You can carry it to the House, okay, and to the Senate, Lou Frederick, and
okay, to the full.
Madam Co-Chair will carry it to the full Ways and Means.
Perfect.
Okay? Anything more to come before us? We are meeting tomorrow, a very important meeting with a very important vote, so we will need you all here.
Sir,
you all here.
Sir, go check on the video.